When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to TMZ Live. Harvey Levin here.
Charles here.
So Ellen DeGeneres is back. After being essentially canceled for a kind of scandal around her talk show toward the end, and she is opening up about that, how she felt about it, and why she's coming back.
She is actually going back to stand-up.
And her roots.
Yeah. I think, you know, everyone remembers, knows Ellen so much from her talk show now that maybe some people, younger people, don't know or forgotten that she was a tremendous stand-up comic.
She got the talk show because the guy who helped create TMZ, Jim Paratore, who was running the company, Telepictures, he believed in Ellen and took the general managers from all the stations around the country to her stand-up shows, and they fell in love with her, and they bought the show.
Right. And so she's now working on some new material, and she was here in L.A. when she was doing this and actually talked about that talk show and the end of the talk show and the fact that she, as she puts it, was canceled. Canceled because she had the gall to be mean in show business, and she very sarcastically says, there are no mean people in show business.
Very sarcastic.
Yes. But she is opening up about this, saying that, the end of her show really was a devastating thing for her. And here's how she addressed part of it in her act. She said, I got kicked out of show business. There's no mean people in show business. The hate went on for a long time, and I would try to avoid looking at the news. The be kind girl wasn't kind. I became this one-dimensional character who gave stuff away and danced up steps. Would a mean person dance up steps?
I think she's joking there.
She is joking.
And so she is now launching a stand-up, a new stand-up career.
She's going to be doing a special with Netflix.
And by the way,
I'm guessing this is going to be this summer during the Netflix is a Joke Festival.
I think so.
Yeah. It looks like it's going to be fall, actually, Charles. But it's coming. Yeah, it's coming up here soon. Something about that doesn't sit right with me, that there are other mean people. Yeah, there are mean people in Hollywood, but that doesn't justify bad behavior or, allegedly treating your staff poorly. It doesn't matter. So what? There's other mean people.
No, but I think what she's saying is that, she was kind of pointed out as a singular person.
Right, as if she's the only person.
Right.
But to Babcock's point, that's not the greatest defense to say, look, there are other people who are mean too.
I get it.
She made a ton of money. She got so many different perks, and people thought that she was somebody that it turned out that she wasn't. And I don't know.
That's the real point, Babcock, what you just said. It's that they present a certain way and they're not really that person.
Right.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
I think the general public wasn't ready to have that curtain pulled back to realize that.
But you know exactly what I'm saying.
I know exactly what I'm saying.
There are so many people that present, in a certain way.
Right.
It's not them at all. It's an act.
That's what I say when everyone says, oh, Harvey looks so cool on the TV.
Yeah, and then what do you say? He is such a...
By the way, one of the things she did point out, she said, look, this isn't the first time that I've been booted out of show business. Because
True.
I went through this when she came out, she couldn't get work for a while.
Her show tanked, her sitcom tanked.
Sitcom tanked,
I want to say something because I just think it's relevant to kind of put her in perspective on this. She did enormously important things for gay rights. She did enormously important things. First of all, coming out on that sitcom was a huge deal.
Important thing for the community, right? Just to see someone.
And one of the first.
Right.
One of the first. And she has really, done things to introduce people to gay life. And that, it is.
To realize
who that we're you and all. No, but I'm really serious.
Yeah.
And I think she made a huge inroad in terms of people who didn't know gay people or didn't think they knew gay people coming around. I think that's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and I think it will be very interesting to see what the response is to her stand-up. I'm sure it'll be funny, but as far as the public, are they... Because we always say this, you can't take a snapshot of someone when they're in a crisis, right? Has enough time passed that people are going to welcome her back?
I think so, but I have one question. Is she going to use some of this in that stand-up?
Yeah, I think... I mean, that's the whole point of it. She's working out material, so some of it will make the cut.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
This is Giorgio from Maryland. I find this whole thing to be opportunistic on her part. I think she's just trying to promote her new comedy special. It's just a little bit striking that she's choosing this time to speak about this now, but I'm not really buying any of it, quite frankly. Huh. I'll still watch.
Interesting. Do you have Armani stuff? No, I'm curious.
Yes. No, I do.
You know why I said
why?
Because no, his
why?
Name's Giorgio.
I could have gone Marauder.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to move on.
Canalia. They're all Italian. all right, yes. Moving on to President Biden, who was sitting down this morning with Howard Stern. Went on the Howard Stern show for a live interview and talked about a lot of things. Talked about from his childhood when he was bullied.
And how he fought back.
And had this very emotional chat about dealing with grief, dealing with the loss of loved ones. And in particular, when his...
The car accident.
The car accident.
His first wife and his daughter.
Right. And how did he deal with losing not only his wife, but a 13-month-old daughter? This is what he had to say to Howard. And it is interesting because I just find this to be an incredibly difficult, obviously, thing to talk about. Talking about suicidal thoughts and a very vulnerable thing and an interesting decision in a campaign year. But we'll get into that. Here's what he said.
When you lose the love of your life and you lose your 13-month-old daughter, which, it gives me the chills even to say it to you, and I hate bringing it up, but at the same point, I think it's useful that you described you were suicidal at that point. You thought about it.
Well, what I said was, I can understand you don't have to be nuts to commit suicide. I don't drink. That's not a virtue. I never drank. And I used to sit there and think to myself, I'm just going to take out a bottle of scotch. We always had liquor in the house, in my house as well. And I was going to just drink it and get drunk, and I can never bring myself to do it. And I actually thought about, you don't have to be crazy to commit suicide. If you've been to the top of the mountain, you think it's never going to be there again. And just a brief moment, I thought, maybe I just go to the Delaware Memorial Bridge and jump. But I had two kids.
Yeah, you guys, and he goes on to say that his two sons, Beau and Hunter, kind of basically kept him from doing this. And the fact that he started also dating Jill Biden eventually, he found love again, and his sons fell in love with her. So that whole thing kind of sparked new life in him. But yeah, just like to Charles's point, vulnerable. And I got to say, kind of smart on Biden and his campaign's team here, because, voters want to hear this kind of stuff. They want to hear this, like, personal connection. And going on Howard Stern, opening up, and I'm sure, by the way, there's lots of other sound bites that are, like, more lighthearted and funny, et cetera, et cetera. I'll let people go look for that stuff. But this kind of thing, going on Howard Stern, very smart of Biden because, it helps him connect with voters, I feel like.
I mean, it's a huge audience, obviously. So there's the numbers alone that's what makes it a smart move. But
it's a really
to talk
smart
about something like this.
I got to tell you.
You're talking about a mental health struggle,
I got to tell you something. There is a guy, you're too young to know this. But
ooh,
you are.
I like that.
You are too young to know this. There was a presidential candidate, for some reason I want to say vice presidential, but his name was Thomas Eagleton. This was a long time ago. And during the campaign, he acknowledged or it came out that he had electroshock therapy for a mental illness.
Right.
And it destroyed his campaign. Hmm. Destroyed it. He had to drop out. And, just the fact that now we can have a president.
But that was a much different time, where people didn't talk about any mental health
That's
issues.
Right.
Right.
But the fact that our president can come out and be that vulnerable is a really good thing. It's a really, really good thing.
Hey, you guys. This is Dario from Atlanta, Georgia. I just feel like Biden is being very vulnerable at this point. You know, he is the president of the United States. So it's a lot of pressure on him at this time. I know the campaign is kicking back up. So this is kind of good press, but it also, you know, gives Americans that time to feel, you know, just even closer to him than what they probably were before.
Yeah. Anyway, good on Biden for opening up about that.
Yeah.
We're taking a break.
All right. When we come back, Donald Trump on trial. He has a big issue with something going on in court. You'll hear about that when we come back. But what he should really be focused on is that jury. And nobody knows more about juries than Dr. Phil. And when we come back, he'll be joining us to talk about the people who have Donald Trump's fate in their hands. Got something a little different from Donald Trump this morning before he went into court. We've been hearing every day he does sort of the greatest hits of this is a travesty and this is political assassination and on and on. There's something else he's really upset about that's happening in court. Check this out.
So we have another day of court in a freezing courthouse. It's very cold in there for a point of purpose, I believe. They don't seem to be able to get the temperature up. It shouldn't be that complicated, but we have a freezing courthouse, and that's fine. It's just fine. Let us keep handing it out. There's a rigged trial. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
I don't think that's reversible error, but...
I don't think that's going to work on appeal if it gets to that point. He should really be focused on, though, are those jurors, right? Because
all that matters, 12 jurors.
Right.
All that matters. And the question is that when you have such a highly charged political landscape, and half the country hates the other half, how do you get a fair, objective jury, or is that possible, especially in a state that skews one way?
Exactly. Well, to answer that question, there is one person who is the perfect person to talk to.
Eminently qualified.
Dr. Phil, who, of course, that's his bread and butter, was... picking juries.
Jury consulting. And he had he's the one that won the Oprah case, the beef case.
Exactly. So he is digging into Donald Trump's trial with a two-part special that starts next week on his new network, Merritt Street Media. It's called The Historic Trial of Donald J. Trump. And Dr. Phil is joining us right now to talk about that. Dr. Phil, welcome back to Team
Z-Live. Good to talk to both of you. You couldn't be more right. This is a difficult jury to seat. And as you know, you don't pick a jury, you deselect a jury. And when I look at who's on that jury, I wonder who they didn't pick, because who's on there is very troubling.
Why is it troubling?
Well, first off, you've got two lawyers on this panel, and for both the defense and the prosecution, that is a very dangerous jury, because as you know, when you've got somebody with specialized knowledge on a jury, the rest of the panel can easily they can completely defer to them. They get in there and there's a jury charge that's 40 or 50 pages long. They can say, hey, listen, this is what you do, so guide us through this. You could wind up trying your case to a jury of one, and that's very dangerous for prosecution and defense.
What about the fact that there are, well, I mean, I was going to get into the professionals, but I want to get to the core issue. Yeah, I mean, people say, sure, I can be objective. How do you know they're telling the truth, or is there any way to know that?
Well, you don't know that. And the test, people sometimes think the test is, if I know somebody on either side or whatever, then I'll be excused. That's not the case. All they have to say is, I can set this aside and follow the judge's instructions when it comes time. I don't think even the jurors know that. I've done this for so many years, for so many juries. And you heard some of the jurors that were excused for some reason other than what was apparent. And they said in interviews after the fact, listen, I had real problems with this. And they're going to hear things that they don't now know that could be further challenges to their ability to set aside their feelings about someone as polarizing as Donald Trump. So when you look at Manhattan and they all only drew from the borough of Manhattan, there's not a neighborhood, a block, or a street that is not Democratic. You look at how they voted. And of course, they always say politics are not something you can consider, but they've never had a president on trial before. So I think this is a special situation, and I think that needs to be considered.
So how do you deal with that, Phil, as a jury consultant or as an attorney trying to deselect a jury? How do you deal with that when, as Harvey said, you're going to ask them questions, and they're going to say, oh, yeah, I can be fair, I can be impartial. But especially because the country is so politically charged, it's not far-fetched to think that someone would put themselves on this jury, want to be on the jury, because they feel either they support Donald Trump.
One way or the other.
Yeah, one way or the other. How do you see through that?
There could be what we call a weapon juror on here, somebody that is a sleeper in there that has an agenda one way or the other. Like, for example, the judge probably would not buy as a juror. He's donated to the Biden campaign. His daughter has worked for Democratic Action Groups. So probably the judge would not qualify as a juror, but yet he is running the entire trial. And that could be a problem here. But since you go through deselecting the jury, you're left with the best of the worst in this case. And I think it's dangerous. What you have to go with is hoping that if you're Donald Trump and his side, you're hoping that you can maybe hang this jury. There's no way you're going to get a jury that's going to acquit in this kind of a venue. That would be a very long shot. But all he's got to get is one. And from the prosecution side, this is a very defense-oriented jury. When you're on the prosecution side, you don't usually want a sophisticated jury. You've got two lawyers, you've got teachers, you've got college graduates, a wealth manager, you've got a lot of very sophisticated, educated people. That's not usually what a prosecutor is looking for on a jury. So demographically, it looks like a defense jury, but because of the political overtones, that's not necessarily the case. So
that's
this is a real crapshoot.
So when I covered the O.J. Simpson case, it was just a mess because as time went on, jurors were getting excused for all sorts of reasons. Some of them just didn't want to do it anymore. Some of them were talking about the case, to friends and showing a bias or whatever. So I thought about that when I was watching this case. The longer this case goes, given how politically charged it is and the fact that the jurors are not sequestered, that could be a real issue, couldn't it? Jurors getting booted.
Well, think about it now, Harvey, because with the proliferation of the internet, I mean, everybody's phone, you can't get on a subway without monitors playing. You can't walk down the street without, you can't go on Times Square. You can't get on a subway. You can't get on a bus without news updates playing on some monitor. How are they going to not watch media about this? I think this jury, if you're going to try and be fair, they probably should be sequestered.
Phil, this is fascinating that you're diving into things like this. It's great.
Well, it's what people are interested in and what they're asking questions about. You know, everybody's now fascinated with whether or not he's going to testify and asking whether I think he is and whether I think he should. So those are the kind of questions that we're getting a lot of.
Yeah. All right. Well, special Monday and Tuesday, two parts. By the way, how's it going running a network?
Well, I tell you what, we're in our third or fourth week right now, and we're available in over 90 million homes at this point. And I knew this was going to go well, but I had no idea that people were so passionately going to embrace what we're doing at Merritt Street Media. So if I'd have known then what I know now, I would have settled for it 100% because it's going great. I'm just so excited.
Excellent.
Let me just tell you, we're 19 years into this, Phil. Let's talk in 19 years, see how you feel.
Yeah.
Phil, thank you. It's great talking to you.
Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
All right.
We'll see you. Actually, that looks really interesting because he knows this.
He knows.
He won that trial. He won that Oprah trial.
Yep.
He won that trial. And not just picking the jury, but working with Oprah on how to present. Okay, we are going to take a break.
When we come back, Oscar winner Emma Stone looking to make a big change. You may not even recognize her when this change is done. We will tell you what she wants to change when we come back. Emma Stone has made quite a name for herself here in Hollywood, two-time Oscar winner, and incredibly successful, not just as an actor, but as a producer.
Hugely successful.
Yeah.
And everybody knows her name.
Everyone knows like her yours. Name. Yeah, but she's done with it. She wants to move on.
Well, she doesn't want, no,
I don't know
no,
how many
no, no,
people,
no, no.
actually.
No, no, no.
Hold on.
She doesn't want to move on. She wants to move back.
From her professional name, she wants to move on.
She wants to move back.
Her actual name,
right.
If you don't know this, her actual given name is Emily. And the only reason that she goes by Emma is because when she started acting, there was someone else who's already a member of the union whose name is Emily Stone. So she couldn't use that name.
Well, she could, because you got Michael
could
B.
Have.
Jordan, for example, to use your middle initial.
Right.
Yeah.
She could have done that, but she
didn't
decided to go with Emma. She's over it. And she said, look, people who know her well do call her Emily. Once they get to know her, they call her Emily. But she told Hollywood Reporter she's just kind of over the whole Emma thing and would really love to just go by Emily.
By the way, she's done this over the years. This is just an example of her kind of grousing about her name.
People mostly call me Em, and my real name is Emily. Emma is actually short for that, so just please call me Emily.
I did not know that your real first name was Emily.
Yes. It was taken at Screen Actors Guild.
Oh, it was?
My name, yeah. So I've been Emma since I was 16.
So, Emma,
mm-hmm.
What was the first album you bought?
Emily. It's Emily.
Remember?
Emily insisted on wearing a sweatband every day, which is weird. But
well, a sweatband and the wrist ones too.
You've yeah. got to stop calling her Emily. It's really, really
it's my real name.
Is that what, can we call you that? Or
yes,
that,
please. I want everyone okay. to call me that.
At the end of the day, it is her real name, so she does deserve to be called her real name. But it is a little confusing because, of course, she is a huge star. Everyone does know her as Emma Stone. But then you got to also feel bad for like the other Emily Stone that did snag the name first. Which, by the way, I looked up the other Emily Stone's IMDb, and there's really like hardly any credits.
But where is
that,
she?
By the way, is where that other is Emily, she? Is that her given name? Do we know?
Or oh, it probably
or did
is.
She take that as a stage name?
You know what? It doesn't say.
I guess it wouldn't say
there. It
doesn't
matter.
Yeah,
it
wouldn't
I'm
say looking there. Right now. Matter. She has very few credits, but it says that she is an actress, producer, and writer.
When?
So.
If they,
it's
if
not she, like a trademark, like she's not using
no,
it enough,
that.
So...
She, but if Emma Stone couldn't have done it before, and she wants to do it now, what's going on with the other Emily Stone?
What she should do is negotiate with the other Emily Stone, have the other Emily Stone
go
put
what?
In the initial. Have that one put in an initial, and then she can just, Emma can just be Emily Stone. It's all, look, we can all work these things out. It's, you
she
know.
Could have just put her middle initial, like you guys said, because her middle name is Jean. So it could have been Emily J. Stone, which actually, now that I say it, doesn't sound as good.
Hey, guys, this is Shannon from Boston. And I agree, Emma Stone has already made such a big name for herself. I feel like we've seen celebrities do this a lot in their career where years and they try to change their name a little bit. And it just doesn't stick with the general public. I think that's great if her friends and family want to call her Emily. I know she was recently credited on her friend Taylor Swift's album as Emily. So if her friends and family want to call her Emily, that's fine. But I feel like the general public will continue to call her Emma.
Sort of like Kanye and Ye.
Right.
Sort of. Okay, we're going
to
move on.
Yes, to Kim Kardashian in a very familiar spot back at the White House. This time, she was meeting with the vice president. She and Kamala Harris sat down to talk about criminal justice reform. And Kim says, look, it doesn't matter to her who's actually, what administration is there. She wants to keep working on these issues.
It was actually this very room that I was in years ago, my first clemency meeting, that really inspired me to take a journey of really helping to figure out how I can be helpful and how I can tell the amazing stories that I would hear from the success stories from individuals like yourself. I'm so honored to be here to continue this fight and to learn more every day, every visit. every administration. I'm just here to help and to spread the word.
Listen, you could say what you want about Kim Kardashian, but she knows how to speak to both sides of the aisle better than anyone, whether it be a Donald Trump or a Kamala Harris. She's able to communicate how she feels about criminal justice reform very well. And honestly, I don't think it's out of the question that in the years ahead that Kim could run for office.
In my head, I was going, please don't say this thing about her running for office. That's not going to happen.
Well, who knows?
That's your fault.
In this country?
That's your fault.
In this country?
Think about a 60-year-old Kim Kardashian. I don't think that's out of the question.
I think what's kind of amazing to me is there are so many people who have really made their lives about criminal justice reform. And look, I think it's great what she's doing, but you know what's going on in terms of the calculus of let's get Kim to the White House, right?
Yes.
You hardly need to say it, right?
Yeah, yes, as we say. Campaign years.
Yep, we are taking a break.
All right, so when we come back, chaos on America's college campuses. With all the protests going on over Israel and Gaza, USC is the latest to just erupt. They've now canceled commencement. When we come back, we're gonna be joined by one of the board of trustees, one of the highest ranking people on campus, Rick Caruso, will be here to talk about what they're gonna do, if anything, to regain control on campus.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Welcome to the Snapple Market Auditory Experience. Close your eyes. Imagine you're walking into your neighborhood store. You make your way to the back and reach for your favorite Snapple flavor. You can't wait. You take a sip. Whoa, that's a lot of flavor. What flavor are you holding? Now open your eyes and check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavorful Snapple near you.
Welcome back to TMZ Live. The campus here at USC going through something that we have seen at several campuses around the country. Protests over the war in Israel, the war between Israel and Hamas. And the protests have gotten so intense at USC, they have canceled commencement now. And I would imagine there are going to be a lot of campuses that are going to have to do this in the coming weeks. Because the situation is really untenable.
It's incendiary.
So what do you do if you are on one of those campuses and it's your job to try and figure out how to bring things...
And the other thing, Charles, is what do administrations do to balance the right of free speech and the right to be safe on a campus when everybody there is paying tuition? It is a complicated thing. And a lot of administrators are now kind of flummoxed over this, and there are people calling for resignations as a result. So we're really honored right now to have kind of an inside look at what goes on.
A member of the Board of Trustees at the University of Southern California, Rick Caruso, who is also obviously an incredibly successful businessman here in LA. We're always at the Grove. So we're always adjacent to Rick Caruso, but he's joining us to talk about what's going on at USC. Rick, welcome back to TMZ Live.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, Rick.
We're going to the Grove. Appreciate that.
Yeah, we love the Grove. It's the greatest. So how does an administration balance these two things? That you've got students saying, I have a right to be safe on campus, and I feel unsafe, and there's a lot of hateful rhetoric, and more than rhetoric in some cases, coming my way, versus the right of free speech on a college campus. How do you balance that?
You know, it's tough to balance, but I would say this with a lot of complicated issues, and you see different administrations around the country and universities handling it differently, and for the most part, not well. I think you have to have a very clear line that says we respect everybody's right of free speech, but also when that free speech turns into hate speech, when that speech turns into bullying or making people feel unsafe, whether it's at the Grove, whether it's at a university campus or anywhere else, I believe that safety becomes the priority, because especially on a university campus, it's there for higher learning, it's there for collaboration. And you want to have an environment where people can share their views. And listen, 99% of the time, the right to free speech and the right to feel safe coexist very well. But when it crosses over to hate speech, I think you have to very clearly reject it. And many of these university presidents Unlike Carol Folt at USC, who I think has done an incredible job in managing through a tough situation, I think a lot of, especially the Ivy Leagues, have really failed in keeping the university campuses safe and free from hate speech.
I guess that's the issue here with these protests, Rick, is where is it hate speech? Because the people who are protesting may say certain things that they feel are just advocating for what they believe should be the outcome over in the Middle East. And then if you're on the other side, you may feel like that particular sentence, what I'm thinking of is, we talk about this, some of the protesters saying from the sea,
from the river to the sea. Right.
Right. And that if you're an Israeli or if you're Jewish, you may feel that that is an anti-Semitic
statement. That it's calling for extermination.
Right. And then is that hate speech? You know, like that's the line here. That's what makes this difficult, I would think, for administrations and for law enforcement.
Yeah, I don't know. I want to take issue with that. I don't think it's that difficult. When you're proposing to eradicate a nation or a religion or a group of people, that's hate. Now, you may say, I disagree with the war. I wish Israel would pull back. Whatever those, you have a right to say all of those things and have whatever belief you want. But the minute that the recipient feels bullied, feels threatened, feels unsafe, I believe it crosses that line. So these campuses have got to create an environment where people can express their views, but it can't be a place where people are intimidated to go to class, intimidated to learn, intimidated to study, or feel unsafe. That's just not right. So I think you have to be really clear-eyed about it. I think you have to have some backbone. You've got to have some courage. You're not going to be well-loved in all decision-making, but that's what leadership is about. And so for these university presidents, step up and be a leader and do what's right. I think it's pretty apparent. And again, kudos to USC, their leadership team. I think overall have done a really great job in trying to balance that out.
Although the thing I would say, though, Rick, and I hear what you're saying that they're doing. Look, it is an impossible, near impossible situation. And I hear you say that you feel that the president, they've done a good job. But if you've had to cancel commencement, is that still doing a great, and maybe it's out of their hands, but if you're canceling commencement, you're basically saying that this is not a safe situation, right?
Well, what you're saying is that there's circumstances out of your control and safety is a priority. And I think commencement is all about celebrating these students that have worked so hard. And so you want to preserve that as much as possible. And you can't create an environment where the whole ceremony gets taken over here and becomes an unsafe situation. At SC, you're talking about 70,000 people showing up. And so just to process that, I think that decision was the right decision. It's unfortunate. And let's also remember, which really saddens so many people, this is the graduating class that didn't have a high school graduation
right.
because of COVID.
Yeah. Right, right.
This is the graduating class that didn't have a first year. They were on Zoom in college. And so I think it's sad. It's terrible what's happening out there. I don't know how to solve it other than to make safety a priority and make sure that there's some semblance of a celebration for these kids' hard work.
So, Rick, with the commencement, as an outsider looking in, it seemed to me, and I hear that there are safety concerns, and I get that, but it seemed to me that the more immediate issue is the whole thing would devolve into chaos because everybody would be wanting, or a lot of people would be wanting to make statements. You probably could never
people
get through.
People who are graduating.
Probably could never get through statements. The graduation. So it seems to me that chaos was, it had to play a big part, maybe even as much as the safety issue here, given what we've seen with protests all over the country.
Yeah, listen, again, we've got really smart people that head up security at USC and the whole senior team, and that was their decision. This is a management decision. It's not a board decision. I was not involved in that decision-making process. But what we are going to have is great celebrations at each school. Every student is going to get their diploma. Every school is going to have their own celebration. But that allows it to be better managed, create a safe environment, a celebratory environment. There's going to still be this really wonderful environment at the USC campus. It's just the main ceremony that typically happens beforehand.
We're about out of time. Can I pivot and ask you one thing?
Okay.
What do you think of Reggie Bush getting the Heisman back?
I think it's great. I'm glad he got it back. He earned it. It's the right thing. Too long to have that happen. So congratulations, Reggie.
All right.
We so appreciate having you on. It's an honor. And thank you so much, my friend.
See ya. Have a great day. Thank you both.
Okay, we are going to take a break.
All right, when we come back, concerns about King Charles. A report saying that the palace preparing for his death. What's going on with his cancer battle? The palace is now responding in a way to that report. You'll see what they are saying and doing when we come back. Renewed concern for King Charles after a report claiming that the palace is getting ready for the worst, for the possibility of him losing his cancer battle, and that they're actually, the report that came out in the Daily Beast that actually said that they are preparing his funeral plans, that they're reviewing the funeral plans. I think the words they used was they dusted off the funeral plans and trying to figure out what are the best things to do, comparing some of the things they did when Queen Elizabeth died. The palace did not make any comment for that story.
Typical.
Exactly. And in fact, the person that they contacted said, we are saying no comment, but just so you understand, that is typically what we would do. Don't read anything into the fact that we said no comment. Today, I think the palace is responding in its own way.
They're kind of commenting.
Yes, because they're trying to ease concerns, I think, by saying His Majesty the King will shortly return to public-facing duties after a period of treatment and recuperation following his recent cancer diagnosis.
So that doesn't necessarily mean that he's out
well.
Of the woods.
Right.
It just means he's going to continue.
He's doing well enough that he's going to be doing
so,
his duties.
So, again, uncertainty.
Yeah, they did. They posted a photo of King Charles, as well as they also mentioned that I guess they're going to be hosting the Emperor and Empress of Japan in June, which is obviously just a month away. So I guess they're not totally addressing it, but I take this as, like, they clearly saw what happened with the whole Kate Middleton stuff, and now they're like, you know, we can't just let rumors swirl and stuff. You know what I mean?
Hopefully that is why they did that, but I'm curious.
I don't know
about
that they addressed it.
The photo directly. That they posted, the problem with the palace posting a photo is it takes you back to the whole Kate Middleton thing. Like,
well, because
okay,
you have no idea when this photo
when
was
right.
taken.
When
right.
was it taken?
When was it taken? It's the same thing.
Yeah.
And
now we do know the last time he was seen was I think like 2 weeks ago. And there were actual photo agencies that took photos of him.
He was at an Easter event.
And he seemed like he was okay, but
you can't tell.
Yeah,
I mean, you
really
just can't tell. And you got to remember, that person in line for succession is William, and
right.
William is now dealing with his own family
right.
issue with his wife. So these are troubled times for the royal family right now.
Hi, I'm Melissa, and I'm from New York. As we all have heard, King Charles isn't doing the best in private. Most importantly, I think all he can do and everyone around him is be optimistic. Facing mortality is never easy, especially for someone in such a challenging position. I'm for sure sending positive energy their way and hoping for the best.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Well said. You know, what's interesting is we still don't know what kind of cancer he's dealing with.
Right.
There was
They did not say. Although they were more transparent with him than with
that
Kate.
That they came right forward and said.
I just want to say something real quick. So on a totally different subject, I just want people to know. On Sunday, we are dropping a new documentary on Diddy, on everything that's been going on. And it's really interesting. I feel like this one, it's really, I believe, balanced.
Yeah.
And you're going to hear from people like Aubrey O'Day, who's been very critical of Diddy. You're going to hear from CVJ. You're going to hear from Suge Knight, who has some really surprising...
Very surprising.
Surprising things to say about Diddy. And a lot of other people. It's a really interesting documentary. Again, it's going to drop on Sunday on Tubi. Okay, we're going to take a break.
Okay, when we come back, Jeezy now being accused of physical abuse. His estranged wife, Jeannie Mai, has filed documents claiming that he was reckless and abusive, and her filing includes some very graphic photos. You'll see that when we come back. Well, the divorce between Jeezy and Jeannie Mai is not getting any closer to amicable. In fact, it's going the exact opposite direction. They are, of course, battling over custody of their daughter. But now there are allegations of physical abuse. Jeannie Mai filed documents where she is accusing Jeezy of being abusive with her. She claims that he had choked her. At another moment, she says that he was reckless and that he was allegedly drunk while driving a golf cart that they were both in and that they crashed. The crash, Jeezy is acknowledging that there was, I don't know if he's acknowledging the drinking, but certainly acknowledging that they had this accident in the golf cart. She included photos in her filing that show her injuries and also some of his injuries. He has posted what we've seen. So
that's right. So in addition to the photos of the injuries from the golf cart, she also attaches screenshots of apparent text messages she was having with Jeezy about this, something to the effect of, "Babe, look what you did. I'm really hurt. I have to be at a show tonight." And in those texts, Jeezy appears to be acknowledging it and apologizing for it, expressing remorse, saying, "I'm sorry, babe, I'll try to be better," yada, yada, yada. So that's one thing. But on the alleged abuse front, Jeannie cites a 2022 incident where she says they were at the Ritz-Carlton in SF and they were getting into an argument. She claims that he like strangled her or choked her from the back, pushed her down some stairs. And she says this was acknowledged by security at the time. So she attaches a security report, an apparent security report from the Ritz-Carlton, where the security officer says a staff member, like a lounge server, allegedly saw Jeezy push her down the stairs. He didn't see this himself, so it's secondhand, but he says he came over, saw them bickering and arguing. She told the security officer, "I don't feel safe with him," et cetera, et cetera. But
Did the police ever come, Fabian?
No police report, and she doesn't even mention that in her docs or anything, so that's a little strange. You know, she's citing alleged abuse, nothing about police report.
She might say, look, she didn't want to
get the police involved, but what I'm saying is if a security guy at the hotel
that
saw
maybe
it,
they would.
That's right.
That's right. No mention of a police report, as far as I know, just that one security report, but she's citing that as like evidence to back her claims. And all of this is to say she's pushing back, because remember, Jeezy's been wanting more custody, more parenting time of the kid. He's saying Jeannie basically is gatekeeping and hiding the kid away from him. Jeannie's pushing back and saying, actually, the reason I'm doing this is because you're an unfit dad, you're dangerous, you keep guns all over the house, and you're allegedly abusive to me too. So it's this nasty back and forth. Yeah. The divorce is very, very bitter.
He responded, you know, shortly after she filed those documents and it came out, he posted something denying all of the allegations and said to his fans, look, you know who I am, and this is not something I would do, and I'm purely focused on custody of my daughter. So,
hi, my name is Deshauna. I'm from Grand Rapids, Michigan. As far as the whole Jeannie and Jeezy situation goes, I really thought they were a cute couple together. It's really sad that they're going through this messy divorce right now. But at the end of the day, as far as the allegation goes, there's always two sides to every story. So I hope for the sake of their daughter, they can get this resolved in court.
Sometimes it never works out. It just is bitter for forever. We're taking a break.
All right. When we come back, Sydney Sweeney and her boyfriend at the airport. We're going to show you a photo that has a lot of people thinking they have already gotten married.
There's a but.
Did they?
There's a but.
Did they?
There's a but.
Well, you got to see the photo. You know, Sydney Sweeney and her fiance, Jonathan DeVito, really been through it, right? Because a lot of people, although she admits that she was
fake. The whole thing was fake.
She was marketing the movie.
Yeah.
Right. But waiting to see when they're going to get married. And they were at LAX the other day, and a photographer saw something that made him think, wait a second, are they already married? Now, she's not wearing a big diamond.
But check his hand out.
He had what appeared to be a ring on his left ring finger.
It ain't a ring, Charles.
Correct.
It is. It's one of those ties.
It's like a hair tie that he's got doubled up around his finger.
Which now makes me think, these guys like to punk everybody.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Our camera guy, who I love, Charlie Cotton, he works at LAX.
Yeah.
Charlie got a woman who missed a flight on Delta and missed Sydney Sweeney.
But did not get Sydney Sweeney. Yeah. Keep trying, Charlie.
Have a good weekend.